Okay, well, let's get started. So let's start with a prayer. Let's continue the prayer we started yesterday. I've given you a handout yesterday of the prayer of the Apostle Paul. And we stopped at verse 5 last time. Let's start with verse 5 and go through verse 8, which the 8 ends at the top of the second column. Let's pray that together. You are my rest. Give me unrestrained maturity. I pray to you who exists and pre-exists, in the name raised up above every name, through Jesus Christ, the Lord of Lords, the King of Ages. Give me your gifts without regret, through the child of humanity, the Spirit, the Advocate of Truth. Give me authority, I ask you, giving healing to my body when I ask you, through the one who brings good news, and redeem my soul, enlightened and eternal, and my spirit, and open my mind to the firstborn child of the fullness of grace. Amen. Well, as I said yesterday, I want to finish the week by stepping back a little bit and thinking about a little bit bigger picture than just the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Mary. So I'm wanting us to talk in a couple of ways about the Bible and the New Testament in our lives and how it came to be. So I thought we might just begin with a few thoughts from anyone who wants to speak, thinking about, so what is the Bible in your life? In other words, I like asking these kind of questions as somebody who, you know, teaches Bible for a living. One has to come quickly to the humility that the Bible isn't everything for everybody. In other words, you don't have to sort of perform for the Bible guy. What I've found is it's really fun and interesting and helpful for us to think together about and hear one another about what the Bible does and does not mean for us in our lives. So let's start, and I'll cut us off, you know, in a little bit, because we've got other things to do, but let's just stop and think before we talk. So, honestly, what functions, what powers, what problems, what promises does the Bible bring to us in our lives? So let's just all be quiet for a minute so we can actually have a thought, and then we're not going to have to think about the thought, some of us may want to. What does the Bible mean in our lives? Silence first. I'll start. For me, the Bible, I was raised a gentle fundamentalist. I never had a crisis of faith. As I exited from fundamentalism, I didn't feel like fundamentalism was a bad experience for me. Indeed, I experienced it as a sort of a sensuous, beautiful, affirming part of my life. But it didn't really seem to work finally for me as a way to make my way through the world with the Bible. So now I kind of like paid to read the Bible, but personally, I find that the Bible probably makes up about 30 or 40% of my spiritual practice. So, for instance, there are other really important parts of my life, my spiritual life that don't involve the Bible. Not only here, but staring at beautiful things. Often has its own deep part of my life. I find myself sometimes thinking about using the Bible to know what to do, and sometimes finding the Bible confusing and knowing what to do. And some of the things, how the Bible is in my life at the moment. Anybody else wanting to say anything about the Bible and you?
I'll speak in silence, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mostly like the Bible secondhand. I didn't grow up with the Bible, and started becoming really interested in it after coming to Holden. And I love people here so much, like a guy who used the book of Job of the stages of grieving, and he did workshops with it and a lot of things. And then Stephen Mitchell took all the Psalms and did what he calls a transliteration, and I used to read those every day, and I like other people's interpretations.
sort of a second cousin, huh?
Yeah.
Let me add one question, and, as other people think. What's your experience of the life of the Bible in your world? I mean, if you're not quite sure about you, when you look out on your world, what's the life of the Bible like now? How is it living in people's lives, positively, negatively, complexly? And you can, if you want to come forward about the Bible and you, that question's still on the table too.
Well, I'm kind of on two sides, feeling the Bible as a great work of literature, and loving the old, like even the King James Version, and then growing up in the Episcopal Church with that language, and loving that language. Realizing that it doesn't speak to people, particularly young people, I mean, and understanding that we need to have it at a different level and open for more people. Mm-hmm. But in understanding the damage some of that has done to people, but still loving to hear that language, mm-hmm. and hear the way it sounds and mm-hmm. it reads, a good reader. Reading without a lot of expression, as you know, you tend not to do when you're doing a reading in mm-hmm. a church, but still, it's just, you know, loving the way it sounds.
Yeah. For those of you just coming in, the true handouts are on the sort of the front row if you want them. Yeah, you know, as I hear you talking, I remember something I might say about mine. I don't think, it's, for me, there's sometimes, of course, that the Bible is problematic, but it's clear to me that you couldn't squeeze the Bible out of me if I wanted you to. I mean, it's something just sort of in my fibers. Sometimes I'm thankful for that, and sometimes I wonder.
Actually, maybe all that creative tension is good for us.
Yeah, sure. No, as we grow in spirit, I think creative tension gets appreciated, doesn't it? Well, let's meander on as and if some of this starts perking, just bring it up as we go along. I'd like to start with one of the handouts, again in this sort of, we're going to step back and in Bible study sort of think about larger than just the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Mary, and think about what I might call the life of Bible. This handout that says at the top of it, lists and collections of writing in early Christianity, and let's make sure that you're either sitting next to someone that has it, because this, there are a number of them over here. Anybody need one? Evan, Dan, are you guys got one? Okay, great. So this is something that I just photocopied out of one of my books, and this basically shows how the New Testament came into being. I don't know what, if I ask you this question, whether your answer would be the same as mine was for a long time, and that is, I assume that, that the Bible fell from heaven and hit someone on the head. And that, I mean, that it basically came whole. And one of the interesting things that I'd like to just say a little bit about today as walking through this is that it it came, and I'm going to just concentrate on the New Testament this afternoon because it would be too long otherwise. The New Testament took probably 500 years at least to come into existence. And by the way, well, I'll probably mention this again, but for me, one of the fun things about being at a Lutheran, primarily Lutheran place, these 2 weeks, is that you may know that Martin Luther tried to change what was in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. He did succeed in removing 5 books from the Old Testament. He led a movement in the 16th century to get 5 books that were in everybody's Bible out from the Old Testament, and that he tried to kick James and the Revelation out of the New Testament, but didn't succeed. So anyway, how did the New Testament come into being? Well, here, you know, from the, in the 50 to 75, what we know is it looks like people started collecting sayings of Jesus. And the Gospel of Mark was composed. The not on here is the writings of Paul. So, for instance, Paul has some letters during this period, and there, although he never says anything about the life of Jesus, he talks mostly about the death and resurrection of Jesus. He does several times in his letters quote sayings of Jesus. Just 3 or 4 sayings of Jesus Paul either knows about or cares about. Then in 75 to 100, it looks like some people started collecting the letters of Paul. So Paul writes in the 50s. Probably by 100, you've got people who have a collection of letters. And by this, I mean groups of people, meaning no one owns any writing, basically. It's too rare. And writing, as I was saying earlier this week, writing and reading is a collective thing. So since only about 5% know how to read or write, when you read, you know that you're reading for a whole bunch of other people. So often a group, a little church, let's say in 90, would have maybe a couple of writings that it's collected that are copies of the letters of Paul. So probably the first thing that these little groups try to get copies of are collections of sayings of Jesus and collections of letters of Paul. So you might say that's the very first kind of New Testament thing going on, is you have a little bunch of sayings of Jesus and maybe a couple of sayings of Paul. And by the way, of course, all of those people, if you ask them what the Bible was, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. Because even the what we call the Old Testament or Hebrew Scriptures are not complete at the time of Jesus. But probably many of them would have a bunch of things, like they would have the whole Torah. They would have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And they would say, well, that's Holy Writ of some kind. But not all of their Bible or our Bible is in play by 100. 100 to 125, just to notice what's kind of going on, because nothing, we don't know any more about any collections. You've got, it looks like the Gospel of Thomas has been, people have been holding on to the Gospel of Thomas enough to start changing it. So you're making different edits. So we have several different copies of the Gospel of Thomas. Gospel of Luke is composed, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Truth. 125 to 150. Here's where the first idea of authoritative scriptures develops, begins to develop. That is, that you could have a collection of scriptures for Christians that would be authoritative on some level. And here you're starting this, the sort of the aura of Paul is growing. So, for instance, in 125 to 150, you've got the letter of Titus being written. It says it's from Paul, but it's almost certain that it's not. And again, remember, that's not because somebody's cheating. I've said several times this week that people, the ancient authors, unlike modern authors, the ancient authors didn't want to be known. And if they wrote something down, they knew that it was best if they would say somebody else wrote it. So for instance, the writer of the letter to Titus says Paul wrote it. And that's not like cheating. That's him dedicating his own writing to Paul. So nobody in the ancient world says, I mean, unlike our world, in which authors at the drop of the hat announce themselves and get promoted. That the ancient culture is just not like that. 150 to 175. So here you've got the first person who says, this is what you should read. And it's a theologian named Marcion. It turns out that it's a theologian who most people later call a heretic. And so if you know, if you read in your history books about Marcion, the first thing they say is he had the wrong idea. But he says, listen, there's a lot of things out there that are being written about Jesus, but I know the right ones. And as it says here, he collects and promotes one version. There are several versions of the Gospel of Luke at this time, and the letters of Paul is authoritative. He says, really, you don't need anything else but the letters of Paul and portions of the Gospel of Luke. He explicitly rejects Mark and Mark because Mark doesn't seem to make sense to him. Then in 150, 175, another really interesting thing happens. There's this, that Tatian, he composes what's called the Diatessaron, and this is a cut and paste version of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So Tatian has noticed that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are different stories, and that they're kind of contradictory in different ways. So he decides to put them all together in one story so they make sense. Notice eventually what we're going to see is when the New Testament is available, they kind of like having four different Gospels that are different. They're not bothered at all eventually. But Diatessaron, Tatian says, listen, you got to have one story. And this is going to be, I'm going to cut and paste those four Gospels. In 175 to 100 to 200, and forgive my zipping through history here, you have the first person who says Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels you should read. And that's Irenaeus of Lyon. He's a bishop in France. And he says four Gospels. And because he knows that there are a bunch of Gospels right now, there are probably 10 or 15 Gospels written by that time, and he knows a bunch of them. He writes about them. But the reason you should have four, for him it's more important that you have four than any other number. And these are the four he thinks are the best. In other words, it's not that he says, what are the best Gospels? And let's read them. He knows that you have to have four Gospels. And that's because there are four winds that blow, and there are four corners to the earth.
And we start with this.
Yeah, exactly. So, just for you to notice, Irenaeus was very influential. that, so this idea you got to have four, stop. And Irenaeus is the first person who uses the word New Testament. By New Testament, he doesn't mean a collection of works. He rather has noticed that up to now, all of the Christians have been reading just what we would call the Old Testament as authoritative. And he says, you know, we got to have some new books that are at least as authoritative as the Hebrew Scriptures. So he introduces the idea, but he doesn't follow through on saying which one should be in. He's sure about the four Gospels. Then at the end, Clement of Alexandria, one of the most famous and most orthodox theologians of the second century, he says, don't read Mark. I didn't know, but I was, you know, pushing Mark hard last night in the film, and it's my favorite gospel. But Clement of Alexandria says, don't read Mark because he's not an apostle. So you notice there, towards the end of the second century, you're starting to think with Irenaeus, so if we've got to have certain collections that are explicitly Jesus' collections, let's see who it is. But Clement of Alexandria said, well, whoever it is, it's not Mark. Next, on the back of this page. So over on top 200 to 250. This is really interesting. For basically all of the third century, people seem to not be interested in figuring out what their official collection is. And get some momentum in the second century. Hey, let's have our own stuff. With Marcion and Irenaeus and Clement of Alexandria. But that idea just seems to disappear for about a century. So you'd think they'd get working in the next century on it. We can't find any discussion.
They were just studying the little bits and pieces they owned?
No, they had a whole bunch of them, but they didn't care which ones were best. Oh. No, they had more and more and more stuff. In addition, you have this Montanist movement, which says, listen, not only do we not care about having an official list, but I just had a dream the other day, and I'm writing it down, and that's really important. So the Montanists are Christians who say, listen, I know we've got all of these old books, but I think my dream is just as important. And I'm writing it down. Again, 250 to 300, nothing for our book. Now, then all of a sudden in the 4th century, action starts. And we don't quite know why. But one of the things, as many of you may remember, one of the things that happens in the early 4th century is that Constantine, the emperor of the whole known world, converts to Christianity. He's in a dream. He sees the cross. And the cross says, and he hears a voice saying, follow that. And so Constantine, the ruler of the known world, says... he's a Christian and begins to push that everybody else should be too. And we do know, of course, one of the things that Constantine, the emperor, now the Christian emperor, up to now, of course, emperors were killing the Christians. Starts being pretty confused about what it means to be a Christian. And we know his major accomplishment is he calls as many bishops as he can together at Nicaea. And he says, listen, I can't get straight what you all believe because this person believes this and this person's believed this. And he puts the bishops under house arrest and says, come out when you got me a creed. The Nicene Creed. Now, actually, in this room this week, some people have said, and we know that Nicaea decided what was in the New Testament. Simply not the case. I learned that in seminary, and it was wrong. So Nicaea decided a bunch of things, but not what was in the New Testament. What Constantine did say to his secretary, Eusebius, was, you know, I'm also confused about the documents, as to what the good documents are and what the ones the bad ones are. And could you write up a report on what people are doing with these books? And so here you have what Eusebius reported to Constantine. He said, listen, some of them are recognized. So at that point, he says, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts of the Apostle, 14 letters of Paul, in 1 Peter and 1 John, they're all recognized as being authoritative for Christians. Then he says, some of them are disputed. James, Jude, 2 Peter, 2 John, and 3 John are all disputed. You can't trust that they are authoritative. And then he says some of them are spurious. Now these are the ones that people don't think you should read, generally, according to my report, Eusebius says. The Acts of Paul, the Apocalypse of Peter, the teaching of the 12 apostles. Then he says contradictory things about the revelation of John. He says that it seems to be either recognized or spurious. In other words, people are really fighting about the revelation of John as to how much authority it has. Okay, then 350 to 400. Notice how far along we are, and we still don't have a New Testament. We think that there's a fragment, and you know we've been talking about fragments all week long. There's a fragment of a document called the Muratorian fragment, and here we can't quite figure out when it was written. The dates vary between 180 and 800. But I would say for me, most scholars say probably 4th century sometime. It lists as the books you should read: Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, 13 letters of Paul, Jude, 2 letters with the title of John, and the Wisdom of Solomon. Now, the Wisdom of Solomon. Anybody know about the Wisdom of Solomon?
Is that the Apocrypha?
That's what we Protestants call it, yeah. But the Wisdom of Solomon actually is in the Episcopalian and Catholic Bibles as a regular book in the Old Testament. But interestingly enough, the Muratorian fragment says that the Wisdom of Solomon should be in the New Testament. That's because the figure of wisdom, which we studied earlier this week, is very important to the Christians. That the Christians like to see Jesus, as we saw in the Gospel of John, like to see Jesus and the figure of wisdom, Sophia, as the same thing. So the Muratorian fragment says that's got to be in something like a New Testament. Then here's what I was taught in seminary also. Is that the really crucial thing is Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria. So he, somewhere around 367, he's the bishop of North Africa. And he decides, you know, like bishops even now do, I'm going to write a letter to all my churches for Easter. Wish them happy Easter. And while I'm doing that, I'm going to tell them which books I think they should be reading. And he also makes a list. So, you know, we've seen people making lists over this century or so. And he is the first person to make a list of the 27 books that we have in the New Testament. So one of my other seminary professors said, so it was decided then. The problem is it was a little Easter letter to just a part of all of Christianity. Athanasius didn't say, and I think all Christians should be reading it, he just said, my folk in North Africa, this is what I want you to be reading. And by the way, happy Easter. Yes, John.
So nowadays, somebody has a reading list or something, and you just go to Amazon or bookstore and you get those books. So how do these people have access to these various collections of books that are recommended?
Oh, do you mean how do people get the traditional New Testament or all the other?
Well, yeah, like here, okay, you need to read these books. So that, I mean, where did they, if they were to go ahead and read these books, where would they find them?
Oh, great question. Because hardly anybody can read, of course, and reading is a public thing that you do when you go to church, especially if somebody else in the congregation can read. You have by this time mainly monks, having the job of copying things. So there are a lot. There is a kind of a cottage industry of copying books. And there are a lot. So, for instance, by the end of the second century, there is a library, a Christian library in Alexandria, Egypt, that has hundreds of writings.
Now, are those writings then like the ones we talked about earlier, without punctuation, without?
All of them are without punctuation, without capitalization, and spaces between the letters.
And those few people who knew how to read, they were able to read.
Yeah, they had to practice. They practiced. And the cool thing, because we have these wonderful manuals of how to read. There are books about how to read a book. And that the main instructions are read out loud, even when you're practicing. Read out loud, because what this is really for is the community. Then in 400, you have this apostolic constitution. This is a written in the first part of the 5th century and is known as one of the most orthodox writings of its time. And it, too, is interested in what the New Testament should have in it. Nobody, by the way, at this point is making New Testaments. These are just lists. The Apostolic Constitutions, their lists includes everything that Athanasius' list did except Revelation. It says no Revelation. And it writes 8 new books and says, plus mine 8 new books. So in other words, here we are at the beginning of the 5th century and it's still very disputed. Now, this is the end of my handout. I just want to say that in the 5th century, things start getting, there is a kind of not only collection, but a encouraging of churches to read what becomes the New Testament in really an interesting way. So Jerome is a scholar who is mainly a translator. And the Council of Chalcedon says to him, an earlier regional council said to him, would you please translate all of this Greek material, because it's all in Greek, into the language that most of us speak, which is Latin. So Jerome is, by a group of church authorities in Rome, is contracted with to translate the entire Old Testament and the 27 books that we have in the New Testament into Latin. So that, in the 5th century, then becomes a major constellation of authority, and you begin to say, oh, these are the books, mainly because those are the books you have in your language. And the really interesting thing, I'll get you in a moment, Jeff, the really interesting thing, of course, is that means that people who are still speaking Greek, or the very intensely developed Syrian church, or the Ethiopian church, all of them don't have, they're not reading Latin, and all of them, even to this day, have different canons, different books in the New Testament. So, for instance, our New Testament is not worldwide even now, because the Syrian and the Ethiopian churches have simply chose different works. There's some nice overlap. Jeff, what were you going to say?
Well, is that the Vulgate?
That's the Vulgate. Yeah. Yeah, the Vulgate is the name of the Latin translation. Yes, Dan?
So, looking back now, how good of a job did Jerome do translating the Greek into Latin?
Pretty good. I mean, yeah, it's a pretty good translation. I think there are people who criticize what he does. And see, I mean, being a translator myself from a bunch of ancient languages, I just have to say that you find this in Jerome, you have to be really humble because you know you can't get it right. In other words, they're like in English, there are words in English that actually mean that have two words for them in Spanish. And that's simply true of all language. So an experienced translator like Jerome can't be very puffed up. And he talks about his problems in translating. And I think people would say that he does make some mistakes in that. But I guess I would want to say I tend to think it had a lot of integrity to it. In fact, I would want to say what I just described has a lot of integrity. The whole process, which is what you may notice is sloppy, inconsistent, and there's never a church council who decides anything. Did you hear me quote a church council? To a certain extent, I'm mistaken, because there was a worldwide church council of the Catholic Church that did decide what's in the New Testament, and that's the Council of Trent. Anybody know when the Council of Trent met? The 16th century. So the first time the Catholic Church makes a proclamation of what's in the New Testament was 500 years ago. And that's, of course, not because people weren't reading what is our Bible then, but because at that point Luther's trying to kick some books out of the Bible. So the Council of Trent is mostly trying to say really clearly, no, this is our Bible! Because Luther just kicked out 5 books from the Old Testament and was trying to kick out 2 from the New Testament. So Trent wasn't saying we've finally figured it out. He was saying somebody's messing with this. Another really wonderful and interesting, wonderfully integrity, has so much integrity about Luther, is Luther was a real scholar, and he said the reason he kicked these five books out of the Old Testament is he couldn't find a Hebrew manuscript for them. And he said, if I can't find something written in the language of Israel, because at that point they only had Greek manuscripts of it, he says it's not authoritative enough. So he kicked Ecclesiasticus, Baruch, Wisdom of Solomon, and 2 of the two other books, two of the Maccabees out. And wonderfully ironic is that in the 19th century we did find a Hebrew manuscript for Ecclesiasticus. So if we were really Lutheran, we would have put the Ecclesiasticus back in. This week have been reading the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Mary alongside of each other, one of the things that we need to have kept thinking is, does the Gospel of Mary have similar authority or not to the Gospel of John? And that's still a really important question that I don't think can get decided now. But the really interesting thing is that, you know, as we said, the Gospel of Mary only appeared in our world 40 years ago. We know that it was very ancient, probably written around the same time as the Gospel of Luke, but nobody is talking about it in the intervention. We have nobody saying, don't read the Gospel of Mary. Nothing that says that.
But did any of those lists even allude to it at all?
No, okay. Nobody's. It's as if. I mean, it's really. We don't know what it. Because, for instance, Irenaeus, who's kind of the grumpiest of the second century folks, he says, I know about the Gospel of Truth, which is one we found at Nag Hammadi, too. And he said, don't read the Gospel of Truth. So occasionally a writer will say, don't do that. But there's no mention of Mary. And now we have two copies, two incomplete copies of the Gospel of Mary from different places. So, in other words, I just say, well, then I guess the other thing to say about this, and we'll probably be talking about this next week again. I haven't said this all week, so I should say this. It's kind of a Three Bears way of thinking. We scholars and church people, as these about 100 new documents have been discovered in the last 125 years, we've done a pretty poor job of receiving them. I think this is mainly on us scholars. Because more or less the first response was, these must be inferior documents that are somehow heretical. So, I mean, that's basically the way we scholars receive these new discoveries. And so you'll find the early writings about something as beautifully authentic and orthodox as the teaching of the 12 apostles, which was discovered in 1866. People will say, there must be something wrong with it. But the longer we've looked at it, we find only really amazing, powerful, very orthodox stuff in it. And some creative new metaphors as well. So we scholars did a terrible job of that. The church willingly followed suit. And so the first way of receiving all of this new stuff, and remember how we just got these new documents, is that the Europeans and Americans started traveling in the 19th century to the Near East and discovered that things were dry enough in Egypt that they could find really ancient documents. So it wasn't that somebody said, oh, we're tired of the old stuff. It was just authentic interest in that. But the scholars, by and large, got kind of scared at how much they were finding. Now, Elaine Pagels, who wrote the book, The Gnostic Gospels, at the end of the 1970s, she has a really different take on this. And on the one hand, I think we need to and Elaine's a friend. We have to give her so much credit because she, in the Gnostic Gospels, started quoting a bunch of this discovered material. She was a Harvard-educated and then a Princeton professor, and so people listened to her. And she said, I don't know, has anybody read the Gnostic Gospels? It's one of the best-selling books on New Testament in the last 50 years. She is still selling well. And she and I have argued about what I'm now going to say, so I'm not talking behind her back. She says, listen, look at all this new stuff. She says, I think it's better than the traditional stuff. So for me, Elaine is a romantic about discovering new stuff. Because I think that some of it is really beautiful and powerful and spiritual, but some of it is pretty junky. I mean, again, I'm not wanting to say therefore the traditional New Testament is all good, because of course, just for example, there are 7 different places in the traditional New Testament that says slaves obey your masters. So I don't want to hold that up, but I think for me, Elaine has sort of inverted the mistake of scholars by saying, no, they're not all heretical, they're actually all better. So I'm tending to say, so we're in a situation that nobody else in Christianity has ever been in before. We've got some new stuff on our hands. Some of it's is already really moving spiritually to a lot of Christians. But it seems like to say quickly it's heretical or quickly it's the best, both would be, you see my Three Bears analogy. both of those might be kind of too soon as categorical judgments. So it seemed like there's a little, and of course, Luther's one to remind us that even after we think the Bible is set, some people have ideas and say, maybe let's shift a little bit. Oh, shoot, I went over without even noticing time. I was going to have us then talk about how you feel about this. but we've got another really exciting program at 5 that we get to, where we get to review what we've been feeling in our worship. We'll pick this up next week as we return. Next week, the week-long theme is going to be the cosmic dimensions of the Gospel of John. It's a really different kind of gospel than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's very cosmic, and we're going to use some of these newly discovered documents to hear other similar cosmic voices from early Christianity that will help us kind of tune into the Gospel of John. And we probably will sort of, you know, gently kiss the Gospel of Mary goodbye, since we were talking about kissing yesterday. So anyway, thank you.